He opened it, and Roland wasn't surprised to find an armed woman on the other side. She wore the same dark uniform as the ones from the warehouse, her guns strapped to her hip. She didn't even look him in the eyes as he walked by. "I'll bring you to your room, and then you can meet the others." The corridor was like something from a science fiction movie. The walls were curved and molded plastic. Computer screens sat every 50 or so yards along the way, and Roland couldn't wait to explore the software. He still didn't know where he was or what kind of structure they were inside. He expected he'd learn soon enough. The few people in this corridor were all armed, and they each nodded deferentially toward Howard as they walked toward the end of the hallway. Hound leaned forward, a scanner buzzing over his eyes. The thick double door hissed and separated in the middle, revealing a new corridor.
"The quarters are this way. You'll have your own room. I hope that's satisfactory."
Hound's boots echoed on the hard floor, and Roland followed quickly behind. A few minutes later, they'd passed other regular people, each wearing white jumpsuits or matching pants and a white T-shirt. They stared after Roland, and he studied their faces, trying to figure out who they were. A new corridor on the dormitory level appeared on their right, and Hound smiled at a young woman playing on a tablet near her door.
"This is it," Hound said, tapping the control button, revealing a suite.
"This is mine?" Roland asked.
"It is. I expect big things from you, Roland. Be a leader, and you'll be doing our people a great service. I'll send someone to give you a tour in an hour. Shower, get changed, and relax. Welcome to Eden."
"Eden,"
Roland repeated the word, goosebumps rising on his arms. The door shut, leaving Roland alone in his room. His jaw dropped as he saw through the pane of glass beside the bed. Fish swam by the window in brightly colored schools. He rushed across the space, banging his shin against the bed as he did so, barely even registering the pain.
"What have you gotten yourself into, Raleigh?"
he asked himself. From here he couldn't see much, only the gentle curve of the structure they were inside. He had no way of calculating how deep they were, but he suspected it was far enough below the surface to withstand the coming calamities. He was safe here, as safe as anyone on Earth could be, and that would have to be adequate. An outfit was laid out on the bed, and he scanned to find a desk against the adjacent wall. A tablet and computer were also there, shiny and new. To his left was a private bathroom, the finishes stark white and futuristic. He didn't know where he was, but he could become used to this. Paradise was sounding better and better. He silently wondered what had happened to the FBI agent and the Marine, but he didn't think he'd ever find out. With one last gaze into the depths of the Pacific, Roland stripped from his grubby clothing and started the shower.
33. Andrew. 2 days left.
The helicopter listed sharply to one side, and Andrew struggled to compensate in the swirling blizzard of ash that the rotors were kicking up around them.
"What are you doing?"
Kendra screamed, her voice barely audible above the sound of the helicopter. Andrew risked a glance over his shoulder to see her pulling the Reverend inside.
"What the hell?"
he roared, struggling to gain altitude amidst the storm of ash coming off the roof.
"What is she doing in here?"
"I couldn't just kick her off,"
Kendra said as she slid the door shut.
"Everyone sit down and put on your headsets."
Andrew spared a hand from the controls to put on his own headset. As soon as they gained some altitude, the blizzard of ash parted and sunlight came pricking through. The first light of dawn was already blushing on the horizon. As he banked around, heading for the coast, he saw the hospital crumbling into the floodwaters below. The water swallowed the entire building without a trace, taking the people they'd been forced to leave behind down with it. Tilting the helicopter forward for maximum thrust, Andrew raced over the dark, debris-covered water, moving for the choppy ocean beyond. There was no sign of the former coastline or the town of Eureka, but Andrew did spot a bridge. It crossed over what used to be the bay to the peninsula, where the Marines and Coast Guard had their bases. The bridge was elevated just enough to rise above the flood, but now it was bucking hard with the earthquake. Andrew watched as half of the cables snapped and it tipped into the water, collapsing with a giant splash. Only the pillars remained standing.
"We need to fly south,"
Kendra said, her voice coming loud and clear through Andrew's headset.
"And we should increase altitude in case—"
She didn't have time to finish that thought. The black canvas of water and debris below them shivered hard, blurring into an indistinguishable gray sheet, and then it dropped away, vanishing in a dark, sucking canyon.
"Shit!"
Andrew cried, even as the rush of air running into that sudden vacuum sucked them down with the land. Alarms screamed to life inside the cockpit, and Andrew slammed the throttle all the way up. The engines moaned and shivered, straining to keep the helicopter aloft in the thin air. The water came rushing up to greet them, no longer a solid gray sheet of water, but a marshy field of debris. The floodwaters had momentarily run away, sucked into the earth, along with the California coast. Dead ahead, a sheer black cliff appeared, with water raging over it in a massive wave.
"Look out!"
Kendra screamed. He pulled up hard, shouting the whole way. The wave curled around them, and something tugged the helicopter, slapping the underside and sending them skipping up higher into the air. The crash of that wave in their wake sounded like worlds colliding. It took Andrew a moment to realize that it wasn't the sound of the helicopter exploding around them.
"We made it,"
he breathed. Banking south again, he headed along that sheer, black ridge, an instant mountain range that had formed where the fault line used to be. The tsunami was racing inland, and water still poured over the cliffs in the biggest waterfall that the world had likely ever seen.
"Wow,"
Kendra breathed.
"It was all true,"
Hank said in a cracking voice.
"What are we going to do now?"
A massive clap of thunder interrupted them, and Andrew peered up at the sky, hoping they wouldn't have to deal with an electrical storm on top of everything else. But the sky was relatively clear and bright red with the rising sun. The moon hung close above the horizon, blurry with smoke, and almost as red as the sky.
"What was that?"
Kendra asked. No one dared to venture an answer. By now, they all had a pretty good idea. It wasn't long before they began to see the black wall of clouds rolling in from the east. Andrew flew west over the ocean as fast as he could, but the clouds of ash chased them, darkening the sky. Bright, flaming chunks of debris scattered around them.
"What the hell?" Andrew muttered.
"Must be debris ejected from the caldera,"
Kendra said.
"They'll burn up on re-entry."
"We'd better hope so. If a molten chunk of rock hits us, we're done."
Reverend Shelley spoke next.
"And the stars of the sky fell to the earth, as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind."
"Are you kidding me?" Andrew glanced back. The Reverend didn't even have her Bible with her. She was sitting beside the two kids and Hank, her hands folded in her lap. Kendra was seated opposite, her gun trained on the Reverend.
"Are you spouting that from memory?"
he demanded.
"Of course,"
the Reverend replied.
"Memorizing scripture is an important discipline."
"Well, stop it. I need to focus on flying. We're not out of this yet."
Miraculously, Shelley left it at that. After about a minute, Kendra's head poked between the front seats. She held out her phone and the GPS app for him to see. She'd zoomed it out, and there were two icons on the map. One was their current location, marked by a white triangle, the other a blinking red dot that marked the coordinates Roland had sent. Andrew grabbed the phone.
"Thanks,"
he said, and balanced the screen in the cockpit where he could keep an eye on it and make adjustments as needed. Kendra had found a way to mark the range to the target coordinates, but unfortunately, the distance was still 470 miles.
"This is going to be close,"
he muttered.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Hank asked.
"It means you better pray that we make it."
"I already am,"
Reverend Shelley said. The farther they flew from land, the more the sky lightened and cleared. The ocean turned dark blue, visibly rippling with waves racing ahead of them, They would turn into tsunamis when they reached Japan and China, but Hawaii would be first, among all the other Pacific islands. Andrew shuddered to think about all the people who were about to get swept away. He hoped they'd already evacuated to higher ground.
"Diane needs to pee," Hank said. "Find her a bucket. We ditched everything, then tell her to hold it."
"How much farther?" Kendra asked, her head appearing between the seats again. Andrew frowned at her phone and shook his head. The white triangle that represented them on the map was just a few millimeters from the blinking red dot of their destination, but the fuel gauge was busy dropping below the final dash.
22 miles, Kendra breathed. "Do we have enough fuel for that?"
"Yeah," he lied, maybe saying it aloud would make it true. The engines hiccuped and the helicopter shuddered.
"What was that?"
Kendra asked sharply.
"Turbulence," Andrew said.
He glanced over his shoulder, his gaze impressing upon Kendra the truth. A muscle twitched in her cheek, and she returned to her seat. A second later, he heard her talking to the kids, telling them they were going to play a game. Simon Says. Simon told them to tuck their heads between their knees. That charade was for Diane's benefit, but it was a nice gesture. The engines hiccuped again, more violently this time, and they lost precious altitude. Andrew tried backing off the throttle to burn less fuel, but that also slowed their airspeed. There weren't any shortcuts he could think of to get them across the last 20 miles.
Besides maybe tossing the Reverend out, that could help.
He smirked at the thought, then checked himself for laughing about murder. It wasn't her beliefs that bothered him, it was her attitude. Of all the attitudes to have at the end of the world, smug prophet had to be the worst. Another hiccup, and this time the engines choked long and hard. They lost hundreds of feet, and everyone started screaming.
"Simon says tuck your heads," Kendra said again.
Andrew eased off the throttle some more, giving up even more airspeed. That was when he noticed something pricking through the misty horizon. A cluster of ships tossing in the waves. Container ships without the containers. And in the middle of that formation, five fat pillars were rising out of the ocean with a platform raised high above them. It was like a giant oil rig, rocking and tilting with the tsunamis rolling by.
"I can see it," Andrew said, angling down for the platform atop those pillars.
As they raced over the rippled water, two of the container ships cracked apart and sank before his eyes, amidst gasps and exclamations from the passengers.
"I think we're going to make it," Andrew said as the platform grew large below them.
Large was an understatement. The facility was massive. The deck was easily the size of a football field, but square, not rectangular. A dozen other helicopters were landed on the deck, all arrayed around a dome-shaped central structure. With the way the platform was swaying in the waves, Andrew was surprised they weren't all sliding off. He picked a space between two of them and hovered down, trying to judge the timing of their landing, but with the platform seesawing under them, he knew it wasn't going to work.
"Everyone brace yourselves!"
"Tuck your heads!"
Kendra screamed again. One of the skids touched the deck just as the platform came tilting up under them. It kicked the helicopter back into the air. Andrew forced them down again and killed the rotors as the skids hit once more. This time both skids made contact, but the platform came tilting up beneath them, and a horrendous screeching of metal on concrete cut through the dying whine of the engines. They were sliding toward the edge in a sheer drop to the water below.
"Everybody out!"
Andrew cried, already fumbling with his flight harness. Buckles unsnapped and everyone jumped up from their seats, falling into each other as the helicopter tilted up with the platform. Andrew felt the chopper starting to tip over and he threw his door open and pulled himself up until he was standing on the frame around the cockpit door. The chopper was balanced at a 45-degree angle, the rotors striking sparks against the deck as it slid toward the rippled blue ocean below. The side door slid open and Andrew clambered over to help people out. The first was Diane, passed up to him by both Kendra and Reverend Shelley. The poor girl was sobbing hard.
"You're going to have to jump," Andrew said.
"I can't,"
she cried. The platform began tipping back the other way, and Andrew felt the chopper leaning with it. There was no time to hesitate. He leapt clear with Diane in his arms and landed hard on his shoulder with a sickening thud. His teeth clacked together, and he tasted blood. His shoulder exploded with blinding pain, and he stifled a cry. Diane was struggling in his arms, terrified and battling to get free, but otherwise unharmed. They went sliding down the other way as the platform tipped. Andrew heard the screeching of helicopter skids and rotors and twisted around to see the chopper racing toward them. He jumped up and sprinted ahead of it to the next helicopter over. It was clamped to the deck. He all but threw Diane under it and then dove under himself, just seconds before the two machines collided with a shriek of rending metal. Andrew's ears rang with the sound, and then the platform tipped again, and they held fast to the skids. More screeching sounded as metal dragged over concrete. The open door of their helicopter swept into view, and Andrew caught Kendra's terrified gaze as she went sailing toward the edge of the platform and a watery grave below.
"Andrew!"
she cried, her knuckles white on the edge of the mangled door.
"Wait here," he told Diane before springing out of cover.
"Don't leave me!"
she cried, but he didn't have time to argue. Andrew ignored the sickening waves of pain from his shoulder as he ran to catch up with the helicopter. Thankfully, friction with the deck made it a lot slower than him.
"You have to jump," Andrew cried right before he reached Kendra.
Kendra pushed Tony out ahead of her. He tucked and rolled as he leapt clear. Andrew winced as the kid hit the concrete deck just as he had, but he sprang up with the resilience of youth and ran uphill to reach Diane. Andrew followed the helicopter down, running hard. He wondered if he'd end up sailing over the edge with it. Kendra was climbing out now, Reverend Shelley close behind her.
"Stay clear!"
Andrew grabbed Kendra's arm and braced against his own momentum, throwing his weight backward to yank her free. They went tumbling together. She landed on top of him in a provocative pose, but quickly rolled away. Andrew propped himself up on his elbows just in time to see the Reverend jumping out. Hank wasn't so lucky. He sailed over the side with the helicopter. The Reverend sailed down after it, disappearing from sight. Andrew sat blinking in shock.
"Hank and the Reverend didn't make it,"
Kendra breathed.
"At least we're alive," Andrew replied.
Then he spotted a head and shoulders peeking up over the concrete platform. The deck began tilting back the other way, and the Reverend came tumbling down. She went rolling by them, her hands scrabbling for purchase. Kendra grabbed her ankle and stopped the woman from going any further.
"Thank you,"
Shelley said in a shaky voice.
"We need to get inside before we're tossed overboard," Kendra said.
Andrew twisted around, ignoring the pain in his shoulder, to check their surroundings. He saw the mangled helicopter where Diane and Tony were huddled, clinging to the skids. His gaze panning away, Andrew spotted what looked like a door in the dome-shaped center of the platform. It was going to be hell to cross the bucking deck to reach it, and who knew if it was even open, but they had to try. "Over there," he said, and pointed to it with his good arm.
34. Kendra, 2 days left. Kendra's heart pounded against her ribcage, threatening to escape. That had been so close. And here they were, atop a floating rig in the ocean. Clearly this was the right location, judging by the plethora of docked ships and landed helicopters, but she couldn't help but feel like they were too late. Not seeing Hank standing with them drove the harsh reality home. The world was against them now. The sky was growing darker, more violent with each passing breath, and she locked gazes with Andrew, then looked toward the door on the domed center of the platform. The deck continued bucking like an angry bronco, and Kendra set her feet wide apart to keep her balance. Tony was holding Diane close, helping the girl as they waited for Andrew to take the lead. It was obvious to her the Marine had injured his shoulder on the escape from the helicopter, but he moved with ease as he headed for the door, lifting a finger, telling them to wait until he deemed it safe.
"I'm scared!"
Diane screamed, tears streaming down her face.
"So am I," Kendra thought, but tried to be strong for the girl. "We're going to be inside soon, honey."
Even the Reverend was unusually silent, the trauma fresh in her aging body. Andrew ran, his footing confident even in the turmoil surrounding them. He made it to the dome and pressed a hand against the door, steadying himself. Wind buffeted Kendra, sending errant hairs flying over her face. The Marine tested the handle, and she instantly knew it was locked. He kicked the metal door with a ferocity she hadn't seen from him yet.
His good arm banged into it, and she heard his voice straining as he called for help. Tony's eyes drifted to stare at Kendra, a helpless, sad expression on his face. Diane was weeping incessantly, and she fell to the platform, curling into a ball as they rocked back and forth in the undulating waves. This was it. Their time had come. Kendra imagined how terrifying the events were for everyone around the world. How many people had been killed by the disasters so far? Was there any returning from this? After seeing the destruction firsthand, she doubted it. She could still hear the sound of the hospital being torn to shreds by Mother Nature. Andrew ceased the banging, and Kendra grabbed Tony by the arm, helped Diane to an unsteady balance, and led them toward Andrew. If they were going to be extinguished by the storm, they should all be together. Reverend Shelley was on her knees, hands clasped in prayer. Her lips moved quickly, but no words escaped her mouth. "Come on!" Kendra shouted to the woman, and her eyes sprang open. "No one should be alone!" Waves splashed around them, and Kendra jumped as another carrier ripped in two, the larger piece tilting toward the sky before slowly sinking.
"I'm never alone! God is with me!"
Shelley shouted, and Kendra left her there. Andrew met them a few yards from the dome and picked Diane up, cradling her into his good shoulder. He cringed at the weight, and Kendra couldn't imagine the torment he was going through. His daughter was here somewhere. Now he was going to die without ever uncovering the truth. Then she saw it. A camera mounted above the door, tucked away in an awning. A red light blinked, which meant they were being watched. She waved at it, hopping eagerly.
"Let us in! I'm Special Agent Kendra Baker, FBI. Let us in!"
Kendra shouted, unsure if they even had audio feeds, or if anyone was there to see. She kept yelling until her throat ached, her eyes red and watering as salt water splashed over the edge of the deck, spraying them every few minutes.
"It's no use. No one's going to let us in," Andrew said,
pulling her into an embrace with Diane in the middle. His face was close, his stubble-lined jaw brushed her forehead, and she leaned in, accepting the hug. She couldn't recall the last time someone had touched her in such an intimate way, and she squeezed him tighter, crying against his neck. Something buzzed, not loudly, but enough for it to perk her ears up. The door clicked, and Andrew stepped away, pressing Diane into Kendra's arms. His P-320 was in his grip instantly, and the man at the doorway only grinned at them.
"Let us past,"
Andrew told the man, his voice perhaps a little too loud, even in the raging weather around them. The man's eyes were dark, contrasted by his pale skin. He wore a trimmed beard and had a petite stature, rail thin and shorter than her. Kendra wasn't fooled by the outward appearance. He had a killer's eyes, a look she knew too well.
"You're not supposed to be here," the man said, and Kendra saw two more armed guards behind him.
Andrew didn't hesitate. He marched forward, pushing his way toward the man who'd addressed them.
"We're coming in," he said firmly.
Kendra searched for her gun, but her own holster was empty. She grabbed Diane, who was eerily quiet now, and ran over to Andrew's side.
"Please let us in. We have children with us," she pleaded.
The man glanced over her shoulder toward Tony, and then at Shelley, who'd risen and joined them near the dome. He shook his head.
"This isn't for you. I'm sorry, but you've wasted your time. How did you learn about this place?"
Kendra saw something in his eyes. Maybe it was fear there would be more people coming, that the location was spread high and low.
"Let us enter and you can have the entire story."
He appeared to contemplate this, but shook his head once more.
"Listen, I'm sorry."
His gun rose and Kendra saw Andrew tense up beside her. There were three of the guards, maybe more behind, and only Andrew was armed. Kendra lifted a hand and set it on Andrew's forearm, urging him to lower his gun.
"There has to be a way you'll let us in,"
she said softly, not even sure her words were heard over the elements.
"Eric!"
A voice boomed from inside the dome. The man blanched and he moved to the side, allowing the newcomer to enter the doorway. He was older, handsome, and sure of himself. He wasn't armed, and he wore a brown blazer and blue jeans. His eyes glinted as his gaze met Kendra's, lingering for a moment before taking in the entire scene.
"What are you waiting for? Let them in, Eric," the newcomer said.
Eric rubbed his beard but lowered his gun. He leaned toward his boss and said something. maybe trying to talk the handsome man into leaving their group on the platform.
"Nonsense. Come inside," the man said, waving them forward.
Andrew stayed out the longest, making sure the others entered first, and Kendra walked past Eric, glaring at the man who'd wanted to leave them for dead. The dome was really just a mudroom, 20 yards in diameter. Benches lined the interior walls, and there were storage containers full of mechanical supplies and yellow rain gear.
"Welcome to Eden," the man in the blazer said, sending shivers up Kendra's spine.
Eden. The connotations were deep with the name, and she was curious where they were.
"I'm Lewis. You've already met my number one, Eric Keller."
"Wait," Andrew said. "You're Lewis? Lewis Hound?"
"That I am," Lewis said, smiling broadly. The corners of his eyes crinkled, and he winked at Diane.
"Roland was right,"
Kendra said, and it was clear she'd struck a nerve.
"Did you say Roland?"
Lewis asked.
"That's right. We were working with him to get here,"
she answered.
"It all makes sense. You're the Kendra and Andrew he mentioned, then?"
Lewis asked.
"He's here?"
Andrew asked, visibly relieved.
"He is."
Lewis led them to a spiral staircase and descended the steps, his soft-soled shoes silent as a predator.
"What is this place?"
Kendra asked, gripping the handrails. The entire structure rocked back and forth, causing her stomach to churn. She glanced over at Tony, whose face had paled dramatically.
"Eden, I've already told you," Lewis said again.
"Is this guy for real?"
Kendra wondered.
"The Lord shall provide,"
Shelley said from behind her.
"I prayed for this, and it happened."
Kendra couldn't even argue with the woman. The stairs went on for a ways, and Kendra's legs were burning by the time they stopped. She set Diane on the ground, and the girl grabbed her hand, clutching tightly. Andrew was tense, and Kendra could see him boiling beneath the surface. She had only known the man a short time, but she could tell he wanted to throttle someone to find out where his girl was being held. She was impressed at his patience as they reached an elevator. The guards were at the bottom of the stairs now, Eric in front of the man and woman.
"You two stay here, make sure there aren't any more drifters trying to come aboard."
"Yes, sir," they said in unison.
The oversized, stainless steel elevator doors sprang open with a ding, and Diane peered at Kendra as if seeking permission to go inside.
"Go on, honey,"
she said, trying to sound sure of herself. The truth was, she was grateful to be inside, safe from the raging disasters, but she was petrified at the same time. Andrew glanced over his injured shoulder at the guards before entering the elevator. Tony stood behind him, wet hair plastered to his face. The Reverend was on cloud nine, humming a hymn as the doors closed and they began moving down.
"What is this?"
Kendra asked again.
"And please don't say Eden. Look, I know it's your place and we intruded uninvited, but aren't you at least able to tell us what it is?"
Lewis Hound's smile vanished.
"This is what saves humanity, my dear. Out there, the world crumbles to a billion pieces, but in here, we're the future of an entire race."
He stepped closer to Kendra, and she could smell his expensive cologne, his freshly donned aftershave.
"Don't forget you are guests. If it had been up to Eric, you wouldn't be. Don't make me regret my decision. Okay?"
He spoke low, so low that Kendra wasn't sure the others even heard him. Kendra nodded, biting her tongue. She was in Hound's world now, and no one had told her the rules. One thing was clear, he was in charge. They moved for what felt like several minutes, and she had no idea how far they were below the Pacific. The doors opened as the lift stopped, and she followed Andrew off the elevator. Eric Keller stayed behind, talking to an armed guard, and Kendra locked eyes with him. He frowned in her direction and averted his gaze. Down here, Kendra still felt the gentle swaying of the underwater structure, but it was surprisingly subdued, more gentle the farther below the surface they went. The corridor was wide and at least 10 feet tall, the walls metal and blue in color. It reminded her of a submarine, an underwater safe house, maybe. Hound stopped at a massive bulkhead. A huge round hatch opened as he leaned forward for a retinal scan. Kendra's heart raced as she stepped over the ridge and into another world. The floors and walls were so different from the rough metal materials of the other side. In here, it was luxury, and she thought she could hear classical music playing softly. Diane still gripped her hand, but the girl was already changing, her mood shifting from afraid to curious. Tony smiled as he saw other people down the corridor, milling about in a room full of tables, some of them standing to see the newcomers. Lewis Hound turned to them and clasped his hands.
"I'll have Ginny come and find you accommodations. There will be an interview so we can decide where you fit in, and, Andrew, I must ask you for your weapon."
He held his palm out, pushing it toward the Marine.
"Where is she?" Andrew asked, his voice almost inaudible.
"Excuse me," Lewis asked.
"My daughter, where is she?"
he asked.
"I don't know," Lewis started, but Andrew grabbed the man by his fancy jacket and shoved him against the molded white wall, cracking a computer screen. "Where is Val?"
"Valeria Miller,"
Andrew said, his voice eerily level and quiet. Kendra pulled him away, seeing two armed men rushing to their benefactor's aid. To her surprise, Andrew let go of Hound, and the man brushed his chest off.
"It's okay," he told the guards. "Your daughter is on board." "All signs led me to this point," he said. "Wilkes had something to do with it."
Hound's eyes went wide.
"Now I know why he never made last call." "Is she here?" Andrew asked, and Kendra saw a girl in a white jumpsuit watching the altercation from the other end of the corridor. "Is Val here?"
he shouted this time, thick cords jutting from his neck. The voice was small at first, but clear.
"Dad?"
35. Andrew, 2 days left. For a second, Andrew couldn't believe his eyes, and then they were blurring with tears and he went tearing down the corridor. He swept Val up into a giant hug, then winced as his wounded shoulder sparked like an exposed wire and set her down. Val clung to his neck, both of them laughing and crying at the same time.
"How did you find me?"
Val asked, her voice muffled against his shoulder. He set her down and held her at arm's length, speechless. Afraid he might be dreaming, he bit his tongue until he tasted blood. "Not a dream."
"Dad?"
Val prompted. She took a moment to wipe the tears from her cheeks.
"I tracked the man who took you,"
he said, his voice gruff. Val's cheek twitched and fear darted through her eyes.
"Is he here?"
Andrew gave his head a slow shake.
"No."
She didn't need the details. Odds were that Val had no idea what a sicko David Wilkes had really been, and she was better off not knowing. Unable to help himself, Andrew pulled his daughter into another hug.
"It's okay," he said. "I'm here now. We're safe."
"What about Mom?"
That took the wind out of Andrew, and he withdrew.
"Well?"
He turned his attention to the corridor to find the others approaching slowly. He met Lewis Hound's gaze.
"Is there any way we could go back for someone?"
Hound just shook his head.
"The helicopters won't reach land anymore, neither will the ships."
Val looked to Hound, then to Andrew, her gaze hard and brittle.
"But is she? Did she?"
"She made it to Texas with Mike. They're safe. As safe as they can be, anyway."
Val grimaced.
"Can we at least tell her that we're okay?"
Her gaze slid over to Hound.
"The cell networks are offline. All we have left is satellite. And I'm afraid we can't go around broadcasting anything if we want this place to stay hidden. But maybe in a few days, when things settle down..."
Hound's lips twitched into a tight smile.
"I'll give the matter some thought."
"Please,"
Val said.
"We can't let her think I'm dead."
"What's better, that she thinks you're dead or that you actually are dead?"
Andrew rounded on him with narrowed eyes.
"Is that a threat?"
"No.
It's a statement of fact. I saved all of you. In order to stay safe, you must abide by my rules. Communicating with the outside is forbidden for a reason. We don't have room for the entire world in Eden."
Andrew scowled, but he decided to leave it at that.
"Let us be thankful that at least we have survived."
Hound added,
"Shall we go meet the others?"
He jerked his chin to the entrance where Val was standing. They walked through into a vast circular chamber, what appeared to be some kind of lobby or lounge. The room was full of people dressed in white jumpsuits, all sitting on couches and at tables. There was a bar and computer consoles built into the outer walls between windows that peered out into the black water. People looked up as they walked in. One of them turned from a computer console. Another familiar face.
"Roland?"
Andrew blurted. He couldn't believe it.
"Hey, man!"
The kid sprang up from his chair and ran over to them.
"You made it!"
Andrew pulled him into a back-slapping hug.
"Thanks to you,"
Roland grinned, his gaze skipping around to take in the others.
"Looks like you brought friends,"
he suggested with eyebrows raised.
"Survivors from Eureka,"
Andrew replied.
"I'm Reverend Shelley Morris,"
the old woman said, stepping forward to offer her hand. Roland shook it awkwardly.
"A reverend, huh?
Yes. Cool, cool."
Andrew turned and finished the introductions.
"This is Tony," he said, pointing to the teenage boy, his hair wild and sticking up at all angles. "And Diane."
The girl's cheeks were tear-stained, and her eyes were red, but she managed a faint smile for Roland.
"How old is she?"
Roland asked.
"I'm 8,
Diane replied.
"The youngest passenger we have," Hound said, placing a hand on her shoulder in a paternal gesture.
Andrew frowned.
"Yeah, about that. How did you decide who to..."
He was about to say abduct, but stopped himself.
"Who to save?"
Hound asked.
"Simple."
He spread his hands to indicate the people in the room.
"These people are the best that humanity has to offer. 1,000 in all. They are the seeds that will sprout from the ashes. A new era is about to begin."
Andrew did a quick head count.
"There's only a few dozen people here. This facility has over 100 levels,"
Hound replied.
"Oh."
Andrew did a double take. "This facility was the size of a skyscraper, and almost all of it was underwater." Kendra's brow wrinkled in thought.
"So, with us, that makes 1,005?
1,006. I wasn't counting myself. It's an odd number, but we'll find space for you. Speaking of, there she is, Ginny."
A woman in a blue jumpsuit crossed the lounge from the other side. An elevator with glass doors stood open behind her. She had long, straight red hair, freckled cheeks, and vibrant green eyes.
"Hello," she said, smiling brightly at them. "I'm Ginny Edwards. I'm in charge of supplies and personnel as well as room assignments. We do have a few spare accommodations, but space is tight on board, and at the moment those rooms are devoted to storage. It will take a little while for me to clear them out for you. In the meantime, are any of you hungry?"
That suggestion provoked a noisy grumble from Andrew's stomach.
"We're starving,"
Tony said. Kendra nodded.
"What he said,"
Andrew added.
"Then follow me."
Ginny about-faced and headed back the way she'd come.
"I'll leave you with Miss Edwards," Hound said. "You're in good hands."
He turned to leave, flanked by his guards. The doors of the lounge slid shut behind him with a muffled bang. Andrew felt Val tugging on his arm.
"Let's go, you have to see this place,"
she said, pulling him after the others.
"It's amazing. Everything seems like it came from the future."
"Yeah,"
Roland added, nodding his agreement.
"Don't even get me started on the computer systems. Now that's some next-level shit."
Andrew smiled as they piled into the elevator. Kendra and Roland carried on their conversation about the facility, and Val chimed in occasionally with her own thoughts. He wasn't paying attention. The sound of their voices enveloped him as the elevator raced downward, the lights of different levels flashing past the glass doors. He took a deep breath and wrapped an arm around Val's shoulders, pulling her close. They were all lucky to be here, but he felt luckiest of all. His daughter was alive and safe. He still felt like it was a dream. It couldn't be real. Maybe the helicopter had actually crashed before they made it here and they'd all drowned. If so, then this was heaven.
What does that make Hound, God?
Andrew sobered with that thought, and he glanced at Reverend Shelley. She looked troubled, but whatever was on her mind, she wasn't sharing it. This was real. Eden was real, and Hound might not be God, but he was definitely acting like a savior. Maybe he was trying to save the human race, but even a benevolent dictator was still a dictator. Andrew had a bad feeling that starting over after this cataclysm wasn't going to be easy. How long were they supposed to stay here before they made for the shore to rebuild? How long would their supplies last? How many people were going to survive outside this shelter? And what kind of society would they string together from the chaos? At this point, he had more questions than answers. The elevator dinged, and the doors slid open to reveal a room full of tables and chairs with a long serving counter wrapping halfway around the room.
"It's a buffet," Ginny declared. "You can all go help yourselves."
Everyone hurried out of the elevator, but Andrew lingered until Val had to pull him out.
"Come on," she urged. "You have to try the lasagna."
"Sure," he said through a wan smile. He let his daughter pull him along, all the while wondering, what's going to happen when the food runs out? There was no way this facility was big enough to house 1,000 people and still grow food for them. Whatever supplies they had were limited, and when they ran out, that would be it. Maybe it wouldn't matter. Maybe they just had to weather the storm and bide their time until things settled down out there. Andrew comforted himself with that idea as he and the others dished food onto their plates and went to find a table. The lasagna was good, full of meat and cheese, animal products that weren't going to last long. Come on, Andy, enjoy the moment, he thought. Hound didn't put all this together just to watch everyone starve to death down here. He has to have a plan. But what really worried him was that the billionaire had been talking like these 1,000 people were it. Like there wouldn't be any other survivors. But that couldn't be, could it?
How's the lasagna? Val asked.
It's great, Andrew replied, smiling tightly for her benefit. 36. Kendra, one day left.
You're going to have to pull your weight,
the woman said. She'd introduced herself as Veronica, and her long black hair and pug nose made Kendra wonder if she'd chosen to rename herself after the comic book character.
I don't mind doing work,
Kendra said. Each guest of Eden was responsible for pitching in. There were no staff, no crew to cater to their needs. It was only them, the 1,000 guests, each with a particular skill, it appeared.
What's the end game?
Kendra asked the woman as they folded the jumpsuits. Today she was on laundry duty, which everyone had to do once a week. It really wasn't so bad, especially after a quiet sleep in her own room and a big breakfast in the mess hall. Things were looking up after the difficult journey to reach their destination.
We finish folding these 200 jumpsuits, Veronica said.
No, I mean,
Kendra stopped short, not wanting to bother with this conversation. She idly pondered what Andrew was doing. His reunion had been heart-wrenching, and Kendra was so glad for the two of them.
What did you have that they wanted, Veronica?
I'm a neuroscientist, she answered without the hint of a joke.
Of course you are,
Kendra muttered to herself.
What about you?
Veronica asked her.
She considered telling the woman she wasn't chosen, that if Hound had his way, she'd be dead, cast aside with the billions of other people around the world.
I'm a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or I was an FBI agent.
That struck home, the idea that she was no longer defined by her job. For most of her adult life, her work had been her life, and now that was gone, along with everything else. She wondered what had happened to her parents, to her partner, to everyone she'd ever known and loved. It would be a mystery, like the disappearance of her sister, Carrie. Veronica didn't comment further. They folded the jumpsuits one after the other while the huge commercial washing machines filled with water and spun, tumbling the next load around in circles. The laundry room was stark white, a hospital feeling of cleanliness and sterility to it. Kendra speculated what it was going to be like doing the other tasks. She'd never been much of a cook, so that was going to be an interesting experience. They chatted a little about themselves, but didn't speak further about their situation, as if discussing the world's end would help make it come true. An hour later, they were finished.
What now?
Kendra asked.
We bring them to level 12, where they're laid out for tomorrow's delivery.
Veronica pointed to the carts which separated the jumpsuits by sizes. Kendra grabbed the woman's cart and rolled it forward, the door automatically sliding open as she neared it. This place was state-of-the-art, and it was almost impossible to believe they were underwater. With 100 floors to explore, Kendra had only seen a tenth of what it likely offered. After Andrew's reunion with Val and finding Roland, they'd eaten dinner and settled into their rooms. Kendra was happy to learn she was sleeping next door to the Marine. They were outsiders here, and she drew comfort in knowing the two of them were going to be close at hand. Tony and Diane were taken to a separate level, one with the other teenagers and younger people. She was told Diane would be placed in some sort of classes for the time being and that they could see her whenever they wanted. The girl was 8 and had been through so much. She'd lost her family like everyone else, but now, here in their new underwater world, she had no parental figure. Kendra wasn't sure she was the one to take the role on. Surely someone more qualified and maternal would be better suited to the task.
"Here we are,"
Veronica said, and Kendra smiled at her, trying to make nice with the woman. She was in a strange mood, but given the circumstances, she didn't think it was unwarranted. While she was happy to be included in the 1,000 people underwater, she still wished Hound would share his plan with them. Kendra pushed her cart out of the elevator and started down the hall, following Veronica. The rest of them had been there for a month, some a little longer. Others, like Andrew's daughter, only a week or so. Her work partner knew her way around the facility, and Kendra stayed close, watching everything with wide eyes as they walked through level 12. Everyone in this section sported blue jumpsuits, indicating they were Hound's hand-selected administrative team. Kendra heard beeping sounds emanating from a room, and she stopped short in the middle of the corridor. It was quiet on this level, with only a few people about. It didn't appear that there were residences nearby, and Kendra tried to grasp what the rooms were for. This particular space gave the impression of a server room. Dozens of silver boxes stood in a row, floor to ceiling. Wires were neatly wrapped above, connecting the machines to one another. The room hummed with energy, and Kendra assumed she'd found the life source of the underwater facility. A woman paused and regarded her before returning her attention to the tablet in her hand.
"Carrie?"
Kendra whispered. The woman certainly resembled her sister, but Kendra had seen her almost monthly since her disappearance. She was an apparition, a mask over other people's faces, a trick of her trauma-riddled mind. This woman wore her hair short. It was darker than Carrie's had been, and she had better posture, a surer sense of herself, and she didn't wear glasses.
"Are you coming?"
Veronica asked, and Kendra moved forward, forgetting the cart had a wheel lock in place. She bumped her shin against it and hissed out a curse.
"Kendra?"
a voice asked.
"Veronica, I'll be right there,"
Kendra said, and it took her brain a second to realize the woman in the blue jumpsuit had spoken to her. Her blue eyes sparkled from across the server room, and she rushed toward Kendra.
"It can't be,"
Kendra muttered, but this time she knew it was, and tears flowed freely as her sister ran to her, wrapping her arms around Kendra so tightly she couldn't breathe.
"Kendra!"
Carrie said, her voice the same. Kendra leaned into her, the embrace so obviously Carrie's. She smelled like her sister. She sounded like her sister. Her hug felt like her sister's.
"How?"
Kendra squeaked out.
"It's a long story,"
Carrie told her as they separated. Staring at her now, this was no trick of her imagination. Carrie was here, in front of her, and apparently worked for Lewis Hound. Kendra laughed, unsure what else to do. A million questions circled around inside her head, but she pushed them aside for the moment.
"I found you. After all these years, I found you."
Roland, final day.
"Raleigh, you're going to get yourself in some serious trouble," he whispered to himself.
It was late, and everyone was sleeping. Hound had everyone on a curfew, 11 p.m., and Roland was okay with that. It made it easier to sneak around when they were all sawing logs. Roland's room was on the 34th floor, and after 11, the elevators didn't function unless you wore a blue jumpsuit, which Roland hadn't secured. Not yet, but he was working on becoming part of the team. He hoped that showing value would allow him more perks, and with that power would come knowledge. He needed to figure out what was going on. So far, no one had spoken about the end game, as if the entire 1,000 people brought to the facility were under a non-disclosure. It was eerie, and he didn't appreciate being kept in the dark. The message from Pied Piper 19 had given him a countdown which he'd initially thought to be a timeline to the natural disaster's culmination. Only those were over with, or at least a lot of them had already occurred, leaving the world in distress. The information on the screen glowed against his face in the otherwise dark room, and he scrolled through the data, trying to determine what had happened. The last transmission from Japan stated that the majority of the country was underwater. Africa's population had been decimated by toxic fog as the potency had increased over the last week, and Europe was either covered by ash or enveloped by molten lava. Magma had rained mercilessly onto the continent, leaving destruction in its wake. Roland scrolled to news of South America and the United States, finding the East Coast appeared to have been devastated by hurricane after hurricane, the West Coast no longer habitable. Everything in between was dying, the ash clouds and toxic fog killing the population off. He wasn't sure where Hound had gathered all this information, but it was hard to read. Roland closed the window, rubbing his eyes. The screen gave him a headache, the news a heartache. Nothing would ever be the same. Roland peered over his shoulder, confirming no one was watching, and he set to breaking through the barrier protecting this facility's network. Hound was smart, and already he saw tripwires strategically placed. Roland carefully sneaked around them, his fingers moving quickly over the keyboard. An hour later, he was confident he'd accessed the deepest level he'd be able to. This was the clearance he'd have if he were one of Hound's people, so he didn't feel too bad about hacking into it, confident that role was coming to him soon anyway. "What are we inside of?" Roland asked quietly. Living underwater long term made no sense. Finally, he found what he'd been searching for, schematics of the facility. His jaw dropped as it clicked, the picture coming clear. He kept his eyes on the screen and found a map, a trajectory laid out. "You have to be kidding me." Suddenly, the countdown made sense. Beads of sweat formed on his forehead, and he wiped them away nervously. He closed the digital window, erasing any sign of his hacking from the server. He couldn't be traced to this. If what he'd just seen was real, Hound was either crazy or a genius. Perhaps both. Roland sneaked to his room, part of him wishing he'd stayed in that night instead of snooping. He crawled into bed, pulling the covers tightly to his neck, assuming sleep would never come again. Epilogue. Lewis. Final day. As usual, it was 6 a.m. when the alarms went off to wake everyone in the facility, but this time there was a message to accompany the alarm and flashing red emergency lights. Lewis Hound spoke into the intercom from the control center. "Attention, all personnel, please do not leave your rooms. Follow the flashing light strips to the nearest emergency station and unfold it from the deck or wall. Once deployed, lie down and buckle your safety harness. You have 5 minutes. This is not a drill. I repeat, this is not a drill. You have 5 minutes to buckle in at the nearest emergency station." Eric Keller watched him with a frown, scratching his cheek through his beard. "You should tell them why and spoil all my fun," Lewis asked. "People could get hurt. The worst that will happen is they'll get knocked around and pinned to the floor. Besides, they need to learn to obey without questioning my commands. If they don't pay attention to this, what will happen when there's a real emergency?" Lewis left the comm station, patting the operator on the shoulder as he went, and walked down a short flight of stairs to a pair of empty seats in the middle of the control center. Eric followed him there, and the two of them buckled in. "T-minus 4 minutes," the nav officer called out. Everyone on the bridge went about their final preparations, and Lewis noticed light pouring in overhead as the dome-shaped center of the flight deck began opening up like a metal flower. The sky was dark with soot and ash from the volcanic eruptions, not to mention smoke from the firestorms that were raging from the ejecta raining down. "T-minus 3 minutes," the nav officer said. All of the seats on the bridge reclined by 90 degrees until the entire crew was supine, staring up at the seemingly transparent dome above their heads. Of course, it wasn't actually made of glass. The radiation in space was too hazardous to have real windows. There were technologies to deal with radiation and even to generate gravity and buffer the inertial effects of sudden acceleration, but none of the people on this flight could be allowed to know that he had access to those advances. T-minus 2 minutes.
Primitives,
Lewis thought, smirking to himself and rocking his head from side to side in his headrest. Is everything all right? Eric asked, appearing to notice the expression on his face.
Just fine, Mr. Keller.
They passed the rest of the time in silence, hitting the one-minute mark, and then the nav officer counted out the last few seconds. T-minus 3, 2, 1. A mighty roar started up somewhere far below them, and the deck shuddered violently before they were lifting clear of the launch silo, racing up through falling sheets of ash toward the smoke-stained sky. Lewis was pinned to his seat. The engines rumbled and roared, and dark clouds swallowed the view for several long minutes. At last, the darkness receded and blue sky appeared. The color grew rapidly deeper and more vibrant as the hazy screen of smoke faded. Blue gradually turned to black, and stars pricked through, quickly multiplying, until there was a glittering sea of them. The acceleration eased, returning to normal Earth levels. All of the chairs on the bridge righted themselves, and Lewis reached for the controls in the armrests of his chair. He toggled a rear view on the dome-shaped view screen that capped the bridge and the nose of the ship. Earth appeared, magnificent and close below them, and wrapped in angry black clouds. The dark side of it was peppered with bright orange specks from fires peeking through the smoke. The entire planet looked like the aftermath of a bonfire, charred black and freckled with glowing orange embers. Some of the crew gasped. Others began weeping softly. Eric cursed under his breath, but Lewis just smiled. Everything was going according to plan.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Final Days, written by Nathan Heistad and Jasper T. Scott, performed by Ray Porter. Executive producers Catherine Stewart and Mike Charzik. Producer Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2020 by Nathan Heistad and Jasper T. Scott. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc. If you enjoyed this audiobook, be sure to get more books in the Final Days series today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.